This is Screen Divers. In this week's episode, we are talking about 2025, directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, One Battle After Another. This movie is written by Paul Thomas Anderson. It's based on a book called Vineland by Thomas Pynchon, produced by Adam Somna, Sarah Murphy, and Paul Thomas Anderson, and starring Leonardo DiCaprio, Sean Penn, Benicio del Toro, Regina Hall, Tiana Taylor, Chase Infinity, and a ton of other character actors that we will discuss extensively. Cinematography by Michael Bauman, edited by Andy Jorgensen, and music by Johnny Greenwood. And what a score that is. This movie has a running time of 162 minutes. It is produced by Warner Brothers Pictures, and it was made allegedly for a budget of $130 to $175 million and it raked $204 million and counting. How are you, Steve?
I'm good. I'm really good. It's good to see you all the way in Italy there.
Yes. I'm recording from Rome, this little endeavor. How are you, Ricky?
I'm looking forward to Tuesday. I am going to be on a plane and I'm going to be arriving somewhere near your vicinity, aren't I?
How nice that is. We'll be reunited.
It's been a while.
Let's not get sentimental and let's ask a quintessential question, which is, Ricky, what is this movie about?
Imagine Taken, but with Leonardo DiCaprio with a soul patch and just everybody else being really cool and Sean Penn having this weird tick for the whole movie and then turn it into an exploitation film, which also has nuns.
Yep, that's pretty much it.
True. Now, okay, just because it's related to this, obviously, we're not going to drop factoids left and right in this episode, but there's a ton if we want to. There's a ton of stuff to drop here. But those nuns, if I'm not mistaken, I remember reading an article on Vice or something like that, and there's nuns that actually grow weed. And I think that that's what this is referencing, which, by the way, one of the best lines in this movie is that's a joke on God. Is that what? Is that what he says? I've got a note somewhere.
God.
But the guy goes, I don't know. She's staying with some nuns who grow weed. That is a joke on God.
The classic line after that, do they have weapons? I think they're vegetarian.
Dear listeners, if you can hear a little bit of a Churchill kind of vibe, I am recording from Rome. At the end of the day, we laughed extensively about this before recording, but I am surrounded by blankets and chairs trying to stop this fucking echo and this reverb. I'm recording in Rome from the basement floor of my family home, and it's very high ceiling, whatever, huge table, but it's not suitable for this purpose. However, we found a way to kind of minimize it a little, and we will put a photo of this little fort in the comments of this episode.
It's like you're in the catacombs of the Vatican right now, aren't you?
Is that what it is? Jesus Christ. Oops. Sorry.
One of those words. Back in. Come back in.
Jesu Cristo. Okay, so, in line with this movie, we should say Jesu Cristo.
Jesu Cristo.
Yes.
So what I find really incredible about this, I don't know how long this review is going to be, because to be honest, I'm going to end up saying a lot of just go watch the film. This is one of those films that really needs to be experienced. And yes, this is coming from a complete PTA head that I am, but what's really incredible about this film is that the way it starts is definitely not the way it ends.
Absolutely. It would be wise to tell our listeners to actually stop listening now, perhaps, and come back after you've seen the movie.
What do you think?
I mean, yes, because there's so much about each section of this film that could be a film by itself.
Absolutely. Steve, what do you think?
Well, this kind of highlights a 3-hour runtime.
Absolutely.
It's a long film, but it's long for...
It is, but it paces furiously, mate. It paces furiously.
I'm not sure about that myself. There's some parts where you just feel like this could have been cut slightly.
So here's what we're going to do. We're going to put a little musical interlude and go and do something constructive with your life. And perhaps watch this movie and then come back to this.
Coming through the gates here, we have got what is probably the most controversial part of the film, which is this is directly relating to freedom fighters around immigration within America. You don't really get told what state it's in, but it definitely feels like California.
Yeah, you walk it out, yeah.
Yeah.
But the freedom fighters are definitely... antagonists. They're not protagonists in this film. They are definitely the antagonists, but you know, they are the ones we are following, and there is these amazing put together scenes early on in the film where you're watching them work, and the way they work is really terrifyingly
it's extreme. It's kind of, it leaves a bit of room for the movie to be an allegory. If you want this movie to be an allegory for current times. And you know what? I was having a quick exchange with one of our listeners, which also is featured on our show, which is Jeff Walker.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, this is a very, I can't stand it when he remarks to me the fact that this is a very American movie. Yes, it is. But because it's current, but we live in an age of globalism. So shit like this is happening all over. So let's get it right off the bat. Anyone in the Western world at least can relate to this movie, because this shit, the rise of the far right, the rise of imperialism, again, you know, it's cyclical. It's cyclical and it's global. Nothing new is featured in this movie or is highlighted in this movie. But it is a good time to put it out there. And if anything, when we get to it, I think this is a very controversial movie because it's a dangerous movie. This is extremely dangerous. And for someone like me, who's leaning as far left, yes, it's a matter of perspective, as the Tower of Pizza, as Ricky once called it.
A pizza?
Yes. You could argue that I'm a socialist at heart. And ultimately, this movie has a very fucking rise up kind of ending. And, you know, the generational nature of passing the torch to somebody else who needs to step up. And that's the end of the... It's a happy ending. For me, it's a happy ending.
Yeah.
But if you're leaning right, you were clutching your pearls at the end of this movie.
Which also leads to the actual title of this movie, One Battle After Another.
Yes. Exact. Good point.
Yes.
Good point. We missed you, man. There's loads of guns to talk about in this movie, mate.
Yeah, it was too many. I mean, yeah. Seriously.
One barrel after another.
Well, even if we look at the name of the antagonist.
Oh my God,
group,
you stole that
French
from me.
French 75.
Yes, it is. And what else is a French 75, mate?
French 75 is a cannon. It's one which was used during World War One, and it was basically used, it's one of the earliest artillery pieces which used a hydrodynamic recoil system.
Exactly. Do you know also what else it's referencing?
No, I don't.
It's a cocktail. It's a very seminal cocktail called the French 75. And there's a callback to this, the generational kind of nature of who needs to rise up next at the end of the movie. Because at the end of the movie, as Willa, our hero, she's the heroine of this movie at some point, actually, she turns to be, you know, it's debatable though, but anyway, she is scanning frequencies at the end of the movie. She's listening to the radio and she's waiting for a message or a code word that comes from another group called, if I'm not mistaken, the Whiskey Sour, which is another seminal cocktail. How about ooh reactions?
Ooh.
Right.
Ooh.
Nice.
More. So many cocktails.
So, guys, did anybody on our team actually see this in the cinema?
Is it going to be you? Did you watch it in the cinema?
No. I didn't. Yeah, I finished my watch this morning. I watched part of it last night, and the last hour I had to kind of like sit down and go through the last hour and 1 minute.
Well, you guys knew exactly what I was doing while watching this movie as well, because I didn't want to interrupt the watch.
Yeah.
Should I put a screenshot of that as well? Actually,
I mean, that's up to you. So.
That's up to me. Yeah. Maybe that's for our subscribers group. They literally paying to watch me take a shit. That's what's happening.
Oh, you've let the cat out the bag now.
Yeah.
And now, if we don't put it there now, they want it.
The first time we meet Mr. Lockjaw, General Lockjaw, or is it Major Lockjaw?
Sean Penn is amazing in this, mate.
I think he's major at that point, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know what he's also major into? Testosterone, because he's 65 years old. Did you see his fucking physique in this?
Did you see his veins, man? Oh.
Yeah, man.
What's with all the tight T-shirts?
I'm not gay. I'm not an homosexual. But he's villainous in this, dude. He's Disney villainous in this. It's fantastic. It's fantastic.
The tick he has through every scene.
It's great.
The grinding.
It's Lockjaw. Lockjaw, right?
But it's incredible.
Like I said, it's like one of the bad lions from, what's it called? The Lion King.
Lion King. But it's not just that. It's just when he's walking as well, his walk, when you look at him and he's just like that kind of slightly off kilter.
It is.
Kind of like, yeah.
And you know what? It's good that you brought that up, because seeing that, I thought, oh, now I know where that gun went.
Yeah.
Because I was like, what the fuck's going on here? He's villainous, man. He's
the sea demon.
dude. But hey,
one of my favorite lines.
Another thing,
of my favorite lines. There, it's just like so fucking perfect. But that moment,
we're gonna talk about. I mean, that's the thing. Like, he could have easily be classified as a two-dimensional villain in this, and he's not. It's fucking weird. I wish we got more screen time, but. I don't know. It's just the movie's just right for me. Even the running time is not for the masses. And again, I don't mean to sound like an elitist, but it is an uncomfortable running time for a lot of people. And also, I don't know how the fuck they saw this movie, because it's not what you think it's about. And now that we have established that you should watch the movie before listening to us, so if you're still here, fucking go. This is an anti-Christmas movie. You know, if Die Hard is a Christmas movie, which it is, all right, and someone pointed out recently to me that Die Hard 2 doesn't get enough of that, that's also a Christmas movie. But this is an anti-Christmas movie, because when that comes, you don't see that coming. I actually saw the entire angle of him being the father just being telegraphed in this, right?
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about, man, PDA has always had my respect since Punch Drunk Love. Like, that's a masterpiece. But everything is on. I'm even a fan of Licorice Pizza. And it took me a while to put two and two together about, is it Alana Haim? They always were together. She was the co-star of the other. But what I didn't know is that she's a musician of Haim, because I'm not a teenager, so. Your taste, my taste, it doesn't matter.
My
but she is in the band, and there's a trio, the three sisters. She plays the piano. At one point, I even thought, you know, there's a note that keeps in the score, which is fantastic, the score of this movie. There's a note on the piano that keeps hitting over and over to create tension, which is amazing. We're going to talk about the score of this movie, but she is, if you look at the credits for all the videos, the video clips of Haim, they are directed by PDA. They directed by Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah.
And he's had a long, lustrous career. Everybody knows he used to be the other half of, Fiona Apple. There we go. It was there.
Yeah.
Who stopped doing cocaine, right? Because of him and Tarantino.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny that you mentioned Tarantino, because out of the two, I'm glad that people still like PTA. And you know, I don't know why everyone's got so many issues with Tarantino at the moment.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he spoke out of his ass, and that's fine. Yeah, exactly. He's still a great dude.
But I mean, as a lot of people have said, that's what he does. He's been doing it for years.
He speaks out of his ass, yeah.
Exactly. You know.
But to take away his legacy because of this is fucking ridiculous. Yeah, there's people online.
I think it's all, we're sidetracking here, but I think it's all because he's had a recent release, so he's been having more interviews, and so he's talking out of his ass, and everyone's like, oh, you know. Anyway.
Those voices are represented in this movie by one person. I think his name is Josh.
Josh.
You remember Josh? The guy that doesn't want to fucking give the location to DiCaprio.
Yeah.
You're invading my space.
Josh was actually one of my favorite interactions in this film, because it was it was one of those scenes that just kept going. But anyway, we'll get to that because we're still in Act 1.
Yeah,
what's really interesting, you brought up Alana Haim. A lot of the French 75 are actually musicians, so they've been picked up either through association or because PTA has done their music videos. So Taya Taylor, who played the mum early on, but she is an R&B artist.
Tell me what you want. 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 Tell me what you want.
Tell me what you want.
Hear Miami beat. Tonight I plan on hugging you to sleep. Too, put it deep. Baby, you know I'm a different type of freak.
She's in that awful TV show that has got terrible reviews, the All's Fair TV show by Ryan Murphy. But other than that, she's mainly an artist. And it's the same with the whole crew, apart from, of course, Leonardo DiCaprio.
Just checking, did anybody from Radiohead turn up? I missed out.
No, so that's why the movie was a fucking miserable.
Yeah, well, he's directed music videos from many.
Well, I mean, they turned up for the score, so.
Yeah.
I mean, DiCaprio kind of, it was evocative of a previous performance. It reminded me of the down-and-out kind of actor in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And he does that well, man. Like, it's just very believable. It was a pleasure to watch everyone perform on screen here. I mean, it's Benicio del Toro's cool as fuck in this, man. There's some of my favorite lines are from him. And the first one, that's when I started taking notes, is when, for first of all, how are we going to refer to DiCaprio? Because he's got so many AKAs here, and I wrote them down. So I'm going to go through them with you guys. So he's known, our protagonist, one of our protagonists, is known by many, many names. Let's go through them. We kind of work out that possibly his real name is Pat Colhorn at some point, because he also went by Ghetto Pat. He also went by Rocket Man. He also went by Gene Parker. And obviously, he's known through the movie as Bob. What is it? Bob?
Just Bob.
But anyway, loads, right? This guy's been on the run forever, but then he's quite honest. It's like a confession about why. He doesn't know what day it is. He doesn't know what the fuck it is. Like, he's lived in a state of dazed and confusion for 30 years almost. Like, it's so, and I can't relate to that.
Oh, but you say for 30 years, I feel like actually it's during that you know, the 16 years. Because yeah. I think the whole point of the first act is to show how slick the whole group is, including mm-hmm. Leonardo DiCaprio's character. He is a bomb expert. He is, what, you know, there's that whole scene where he's just verbalizing every little moment of how to do an explosion, and he's getting sidetracked. There's a lot of sexual tension in this film. He's getting sidetracked by Perfida, and but the great thing about that is that when she starts interacting with Lockjaw, it's obvious that, like, she uses her sexuality as her main prowess to get over every situation.
She does, because she's dedicated to the cause. The cause for our protagonist, when it comes down to DiCaprio's character, is love. He's not a revolutionary. He's just after her, and he would do anything for her. So that's clear from the get-go. That's why he can't remember the fucking password. That's why he can't remember, because the cause becomes a secondary thing. You know, it's always been a secondary thing. That's established from the moment we meet him, because the way he hangs from every word she has to say to him about what's coming next, you know, and he's a pro, right? But professionalism goes out the window just because he would do anything for her. But in regards to what's the name of Willa, the actress?
Willa.
No. She's got a very interesting name, the actress. It's Chase Infinity.
So she, this is her first feature. She is, I feel like she's just really young. Like she was in a music video or two.
She's 25, but she plays 16 here.
Yeah, but what I mean by young is, like, she's done one TV series and she was in a music video, and that's it. That's her career so far. So this is definitely the up end of her career, the start
of
it.
She's great. She's great.
And not just that, the chemistry between DiCaprio and her while they're together.
They're so comfortable.
But I wanted more of that. Wanted more of that.
Likewise.
And I feel that was underused. That's it.
There is a little bit of connecting tissue with other dark chapters of the Screen Divers history here. And we would be remiss not to mention Mr. Tony Goldwyn. Dear listeners, he was the bad guy in The Sixth Day.
I'm just taking over where God left off.
If you really believe that, then you should clone yourself.
So I can understand your unique perspective.
No. So you can go fuck yourself.
If you don't believe how much we fucking hated that movie, I mean, I speak for myself, I really hated that movie. He played the bad guy over there. He plays the bad tech bro. It's fucking atrocious. But you may remember him because he played the bad guy in Ghost. He plays the bad guy or the piece of shit or the scumbag or the bad boyfriend or whatever in everything. I can't remember a single performance where we kind of get to sympathize or empathize with this dude. But he plays the master uber bad guy here, or the second in command. But
It's so funny that you mentioned him, because I didn't put two and two together till you said it. And straight away, the image that shot into my head was, do you remember the clone that kind of sits up in the Sixth Day with like half an ear? That's what I remembered.
Fuck. I told you I was enjoying this fucking movie until I had to eject and go, no, the Sixth Day, no.
We moved from Act One. And actually, Act One is quite short, because I did the whole time-checking thing throughout this. So we don't see the titles until 13 minutes into the film. So it kind of has that little bit of There Will Be Blood about it, because There Will Be Blood, you don't get the title until 15, 16 minutes of silence. But we don't get Act Two until we're about 50 minutes into the film. And it's actually really sobering, because it felt really rushed. It was weirdly feeling really rushed, but it's the breakup between Leonardo DiCaprio and Teyana Taylor, and how they basically, because they have a child, they are splitting up. She doesn't want to stay at home. She doesn't want to be, but we don't know yet why she can't connect with her child.
Look, I don't have children. Steve doesn't either.
No.
But I heard from people that actually had a conversation with someone who was going through through it a little bit, or we talked about it, and I was listening because I'm interested. It seems to me that this is one of the finest, or at least that's the Rush part that I agree with you, because we saw little of it, but it's hinted heavily that she's going through postpartum depression.
Exactly.
And I think that's the main thing here. Like, there's a moment in which we see DiCaprio by the door going, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" And she talks to him through the door. And that's the thing, like, even with a running time of 2 hours and 42 minutes or whatever this movie is, which again, Steve, I'm curious to, you know, maybe at the end of this conversation, you'll feel, I wanted more of this. I stayed through the credits of a movie that for, like, it was certain that it didn't have a post-credit sequence. But what this post-credit sequence does, it played music that was somehow hinted at throughout the movie, including Gil Scott-Heron.
Be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials, because the revolution will not be televised.
Yeah, so what I wanted to try and say was, from my own perspective, because I had to break it up into two separate watches, I mean, I have no fault on the cinematography. I have no fault with the acting. I have no fault with a lot of this movie. It's just the fact that I had to break it up. There was no way I could do the 2 hour run and then do an extra 45 minutes on this. I had to physically sit down.
You had to fragment the watch, yeah.
Yeah. And I really dislike doing that. I like 2 hours for me is like pretty much a sweet spot. Even shorter, 1 hour 40 minutes, 1 hour 30 minutes is a good movie length. This obviously is almost double that.
Agreed.
And like, I feel that every single set piece, from even that chase scene towards the end, where it's just one open road and they're counting the stops, it could have been cut down. But it didn't need to be cut down at the same time, because there was a method and logic to it.
I think PDA got to add. Let's refer to him as PDA. It's just easier. Yeah, Paul Thomas Anderson. Yeah. I think he deserves a great respect as a filmmaker. So, no disrespect for him. You know, exactly. I think he probably enjoys that as well. I think he got to play. It's possibly the most playful movies made, not because it's a comedy or anything. There are comedic elements in this that are kind of bring levity to sequences that technically don't have any. But he got to play. It's this a showcase of how to do a thriller, how to do action. And he knows how to ramp up suspense in this. There's a sequence at the end of the movie. He plays with the scenery. He plays with the up and down of the, what would you call those? It's like almost heels, you know, the car disappearing and reappearing, and you're fucking in. Yeah. I was enthralled. I was like, oh God, this is like, then the car, obviously it's an homage to Bullet. We're going to talk about the cars in there because I took notes that are amazing, both of them. It's a high octane chase, but it's also paced like a thriller. It's not like an action movie. It's bizarre. And it's an action piece in this. But it's based like a thriller. There's another one which, from a visual standpoint, is beautiful, which is the jumping off the rooftops and the silhouette of the skaters and him following, which is kind of, again, it kind of gives a fragility to our protagonist. We already see him as teetering on the edge of a breakdown anyway, from the moment we meet him, or someone that would be prone to that. I don't know if you paid attention to it, but I realized by the end of the movie, he's in a bathrobe. All the way through the fucking movie, like the dude, almost like the dude jumper in, it's so iconic, right? I wouldn't be surprised if people dress up as him at some point for Halloween or something. Like, he's...
Oh, I've got him. I'm doing it.
So,
especially those, the eyewear, which is basically straight off a rack. And the fact that it's the eyewear which you have it once you've had vision correction.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a deliberate choice by DiCaprio.
And there's also, it's kind of built in the narrative of how he loses those glasses, because he's got them on at one point, and doesn't matter if it's nighttime or not. And they had to kind of cookiness of the car, quirkiness of the character. But hey, to go back to what I was mentioning earlier about Benicio, and we could talk about Benicio a little bit. There's one thing he fucking says in this movie that cracked me up. I had to rewind like 15, 20 seconds of the movie just because I was laughing over the next scene. And it's when he goes to see him in the dojo. And Benicio goes, because by this stage, what you see, if you pay attention, you see DiCaprio's character looking for a wall outlet so he can power up his phone. From set piece to set piece throughout that entire sequence, because they change settings, that's his thing. His lines up, where the fuck can I charge this phone, basically? And it's quite long. So they go through different sets, basically, and that's his thing. But when they meet in the dojo, let's call him Sensei Sergio, because that's his name. Sensei Sergio San Carlos, right? He fucking storms into the scene when they meet, and all of a sudden he walks over one of the mats and Benicio goes, I think he goes, respect the tataki. Is that what it says to him? Yeah. No. Yeah. Or something like
tatami.
That.
Tatami.
The tatami. But is it not respect? Watch the step off the tatami or whatever it is. He does it in such a... And out of respect, all of a sudden, whatever DiCaprio had in his head goes away. He goes, oh, sorry. And he steps off. It's little bits like this, man. Go on.
I just have to say, just as he gets into that scene, the fact that he goes, I need a weapon, man. And all you got is goddamn nunchucks here.
Get off the tatami. That's what he says to him. Tatami. But not in anger. He points at it and he goes, get off the tatami. And he straight away steps off. Another thing is within 2 minutes, as they rush through all these sets, all these different settings, you can see that there's an entire neighborhood that reveres him. It reveres him. He gets the respect because you can see that he's done regardless of whatever he would do behind the scenes. His main MO is to help and be an active member of the community. And he is right at the top of that pyramid of respect. Like everyone, he has to speak once. Every single person knows him. Even the skaters who look like, you know, a nihilistic kind of force, like a youth revolt kind of force. But they straight away, they go, yeah, we'll do whatever the fuck you need us to do. Straight away. They don't work for him, but they have enough respect for him to go, you say what we need to do, we'll do it. And he gets that from everyone he interacts with, but the cops.
Yeah. I mean, like, Sensei Sergio is probably one of the best B storylines I've seen in cinema in a long time. The fact that we talked earlier about him, Bob talking to Comrade Josh and just being... And it being a commentary to telephone operators, especially when you've got a problem. Oh, shit, man. You know, that's what it is. It's
I identified so much with him in that scene.
You know, like the whole, you know, what time is it? I don't fucking know what time it is. Yeah, but it's like, yeah, well, I've got to end the call. That sort of, you know, that whole rigmarole. But during that scene, why it's one of my favorite scenes is when I was first watching it, and it's a scene now that I've seen 5 times, even though I've only watched this film this week. During that scene, there is so much going on with Sergio that if you're listening to the conversation, you don't pay attention to what Sergio's doing. But the fact that Sergio evacuates a whole building with about 50 to 60 immigrants in with no effort. Everybody listens to his first sentence and just does it. And it's such a phenomenal scene for cinema at the moment. The way the camera moves through the building, the way that little cuts are made here and there just to show you what the next step is. And by the time the phone call ends, that building is empty. There is nobody in that building. It's such a work of genius, that whole scene. And it's so funny. It's not only like a let's clear out a building scene, but it's a let's make the audience laugh their asses off throughout the scene.
I just want to say one little thing, because the whole point about what time it is, and Sensei Sergio turns around and goes, 8:15.
Yes, exactly. That's what I wanted to say. And you know what? He does it while he's washing his hands or something. Yeah. And I wondered, he knows the password. you know, that's the password. I think that that's the password. But he doesn't go on to repeat it or whatever. He just lets him fucking, because he knows that the password's not going to make a difference right now. Right now, that's not what they need to do. Right now, they need to do something else. It's DiCaprio who's in panic mode. And in fact, even it's acted so well by him because it's like he's got a mission and sticks to it. The moment he's sitting on the couch and he's finishing a joint, he's talking to himself, trying to give himself a pep talk by going, don't panic, don't get a panic attack now. And that's exactly what he fucking does for the next few minutes of this movie. And he finishes the joint, by the way. Right after that, he takes another talk. Like, it's fucking, it's great. That's great.
And again, like, Sally watched this with me, and she turned around to me today, because I rewatched parts of it today. She turned around to me today and said, do you think that what Bob did and what Bob went through, that if he just sat at home and let everything happen without his knowledge, do you think the movie would change? Do you think the outcomes would change? And I said to her, no, Bob is going through a panic, as you said, going through a panic attack. He's going through the motions. He is not the soldier he used to be. But this is where my theory about this film comes in.
Ocean waves, Ricky.
My theory about this film is that PTA started writing this film about 20 years ago. When he was a new father, he had been in a relationship with Maya Rudolph. They had had a child a couple of years later in 2003, I think. And this film is basically him addressing what is a good father. Because as you said earlier, there's a very heavy-handed, is Bob even the father to Willa? Or is Stephen J. Lockjaw the father? It doesn't matter. It's a MacGuffin of the piece. But it does matter because the overall storyline is, which one is she better off with? The complete fuck up who has had trauma, who can't even get off his ass anymore and just smokes weed all the time? Or this General Lockjaw who might have a future somewhere down the line? He might, but... He represents everything that she would never be.
Also, it really highlights the fact that fatherhood is stepping up, not biological. That matter for shit. Because, you know, that's it. That's fatherhood then? No, that's not. That's ejaculation, by the way.
That's your ejaculation.
That's not fatherhood. Anyone can do that. There is a killer line from Made Me Laugh Out Loud, and I identified. I don't have kids, but I thought, Ricky, you do. Steve, maybe this went through your head, but there's a moment when they come to pick up Willa, her friends come over, which, by the way, we're going to talk about how John Hughes that scene was when the kids are getting interrogated. It's fucking great. It's a nod, I think, I think he did it that way on purpose to pay homage. But there's a line when they come to his house. Bob goes up to the door and he puts an arm around this guy, Pedro, or whatever his name is. Mm-hmm. That's quite racist, but it looked like a Pedro to me. Oh, Pablo. Is that his name? Pablo? I was born in South America. I'm Italian, but I was born in South America. That's not the story, so I get to say that as well. But he goes, listen, I'm going to tell you something. Whatever you do to her, I'll do exactly the same thing to your entire fucking family. I'm not fucking around. Then she comes and she goes, Dad? And he goes, we're talking about freedom, baby. You know, freedom is a funny thing. When you have it, you don't appreciate it, then it's gone. Poof. It's like, it's exactly. And I thought, I like to think that Ricky would say exactly the same shit to someone again who comes to pick up his daughter.
For sure. Like, you know, I'd probably actually take lines from Taken. You know, I know where you live. I have got a certain skill set.
I would just say, you know, there's no search. Don't ever find you.
I welcome you to a better life.
Oh, that's a cut.
Your disappearance will haunt your parents' dreams. That's what I would go.
Talking about the weather.
So there was one other quote by Sensei Sergio St. Carlos about freedom. You know what freedom is, Bob? What? No fear, just like Tom fucking Cruise.
Yeah. Man, Benicio slams in this
fantastic.
One.
He fucking is absolutely on fire, fantastic.
Yeah. Everything around him as well, you know, and they put it in the fucking trailer. You know when he just disappears. He vanishes under the mat, and then the mat rolls out. That there's some beats that maybe my brain went there because of Benicio's presence in Anderson's films. But Ricky, there is a little bit of symmetry here. There's some of the framing was very. And then I went to look at the cinematographer here. It does have that style because I look at his other works. Like he's worked with David O. Russell as well. And it's got that way of framing things that is very, I don't know. It's almost, it's iconic because symmetry, in my opinion, is. Mm. If you look at Kubrick's work or whatever, anything that is framed with a certain amount of symmetry, it's very photographic. You know, like it's got that quality, that stillness to it, that it's easier to remember than, you know, the kinetic kind of quality that is in an entire sequence.
Yeah, and I mean, Michael Bowman, who was a cinematographer for this, every time he has come to work, he's also a lighting technician as well, but he's been around some of the most famous people when it comes to learning the art. You said about the cinematography, you said about the symmetry. I think it's the most evident of when Bob jumps between the buildings and doesn't make it and falls straight down. That alleyway is right bang in the middle. You know, his fall is right bang in the middle. And it's stunning. This film is stunning. There's like no other words to say about this film. I actually think we're going a little long on talking about this film because I've got nothing more to say apart from go watch this film and go feel it. The only other thing I would say about this film, this is probably the closest PTA has come to making an exploitation film. There are so I mentioned The Nuns earlier. Everything Lockjaw does is so exploitationistic. Even the secret Christmas adventurous society he's trying to become a part of. It's so exploitation. There are so many 70s, 60s.
It's pulpy. It's the most Tarantino film PTA has made. Yeah, okay. And I'm sure that they must have consulted with one another when this was.
But it's beautiful. That's the thing.
There's no
it's
way, like, right? There's no way. With Leo involved as well, there's no way that they didn't talk or they didn't exchange ideas. I mean,
we can surmise or we can come up with our own theories.
We can assume. Yeah.
We can assume. But the one thing about this film that really like strikes me is that as pulpy and as exploitative as it is, Steve said it, you've said it, Your eyes do not leave this film. Your brain does not leave this film. This reminded me very much of Three Billboards, because at the end of Three Billboards, the film ended and I was like, but what happens next? And this film made me do that again. It made me go, what happens next? And I think there's one thing that PTA films always do my head in. Is I go, but you've just established the characters and the film's ended. I felt like that with Magnolia. I felt like that with Hard Eight. You know, it's like, why you've spent this so much time establishing the characters and now the film's ended and you're never coming back to these characters ever again.
I know. But we would be remiss not to mention like the many symbolisms featured throughout this film. There's a ton, you know, and that's why I think it's one for the ages. I think he will be remembered with this for quite a while. And it's going to be hard to top this one. So he's raised the bar for himself as an artist. But the names assigned to some of our protagonists, and one of them in particular, it's almost on the nose because it's heavy-handed. It's Perfidia. I picked up on it more than anybody else because it's, you know, I'm Italian, that's my native language, but that's a Latin-based language. And there are some words shared in Latin-based languages. Perfidia stands for treachery, faithlessness, betrayal. And that's because from Latin, perfidia is beyond faith. And it's exactly what she represents in this movie. I mean, look, this is a deep thought, right? With information that it's useful to our listeners. But then, like a fucking idiot, I spend most of the movie going, are those our eyelashes? Like because they look cool as fuck, and they just thought, that's natural. They're not, right?
No, that's they're not natural.
Okay, thank you.
But they are pretty.
That's how stupid I am, mate. That's how dumb I am as a human. But anyway, the cast. The cast featured in this film, we gotta mention them. And I'm not a car nut, but fuck, man, that sequence. Oof. Of course, he paid homage to Bullet in this by using that car and the pacing of that sequence as well. The two cars featured in that, in the final showdown, because it is a showdown, that's what it is, right? They are a Ford Mustang Shelby GT500, okay? But this obviously throughout the ages has been made in different years. This is a 2013 model that is given to the antagonist, all right, the assassin that works for
the Christmas Adventures.
Yeah, club.
The Christmas whatever. Adventures. We're going to talk about these guys in a moment. And the car driven by Willa is a Dodge Charger LD Interceptor. Yep. Now, very briefly, okay, there's another character that we would be remiss not to mention, and I wish I knew the name of the actor. I think he's of a Native American descent. There is a sequence that, you know, we assumed, and we supposed for a moment that there was an exchange of ideas between PTA and Tarantino. I think it's indubitable that this happened, because the entire sequence of him having a pang of guilt in the car waiting is the equivalent of Butch standing on the doorway of the pawn shop in Pulp Fiction. He could leave. But this guy, for a second, because he does have a code that it's fleetingly mentioned during the exchange with Mr. Lockjaw, with Colonel Lockjaw. He says, I don't do kids. And he wasn't going to take the job. He knows exactly what this is going once he drops her off. He's in the car. The camera pans away from him. It goes back to him, and you can see him. You can see him going, fuck. And he doesn't go fuck, because he's quite stoic as a character. And he picks up the shotgun and goes back in. And that's super Tarantino. That is a super Tarantino thing to do. What is the name of the actor? Because we got to mention him. He's great. I wish we got more of him in this. I mean, some of the names in this movie are great. We got things like Jungle Pussy. Jungle Pussy. Yeah. she's in the bank robbery sequence when she's on there. She's great.
But I think she goes by the name... Her stage name is Jungle Pussy. So
you're joking.
I think I like him more than I like Trader Joe's. I'll swallow kids if he start eating vegetables. New York nigga with the love for Arizonas. I got the juice, he about to start sipping.
I think it is, but don't quote me on that. I've got to deep dive into all of these careers now after this film.
Okay, well, we're gonna have, for our listeners, go look for the name of this. I think he's Native American because he looked like he was, but I'm not entirely sure. Although he was quite memorable in this. Now, we mentioned the evil organization called
Christmas Adventurers.
There is someone that I have high respect, like high praise for. You may know him as David Wong. David Wong now goes by his true name, which is Jason K. Pargin. He's an author. Who the fuck is he? In case you don't remember, he wrote a book that became a movie called John Dies in the End. He's still very active. Yeah. And this is not familiar, if you see the name Jason K. Pargin, stay for those reels, because they're always very informative. He has a great sense of wit and humor. He's fantastic. But one of the things that he's done, and he gets a pass because I have high respect for him, he's released a reel that spoiled this part of the movie for me. And I was quite upset. However, you know, it didn't detract from the enjoyment I would experience. But he did say something poignant that in retrospect makes sense. This movie can be categorized 100% as an allegory for current times, for ICE, for the current imperialistic rise of imperialism again in the West, all of those, yeah? And if anything, it's a call to arms, because that type of extremism, I don't think is actually happening. This movie is very hopeful in that aspect. I want the younger generation to rise up, perhaps not via the means of violence, but there needs to be activism that goes beyond clicktivism. And they are taking this away from the younger generation. And this is the bit that is going to get me shot in a parking lot or arrested. rise up. Rise up. If you're listening to this, wake up. Rise up. No, I'm joking.
Scuba divers' viewpoints are not represented by
Umbar. Get us fucking cancelled. Holy shit.
I thought we'd be cancelled by now anyway.
What did you think that they represented?
Okay, here's the kicker. He does say something in the reel. He kind of spoiled this part of the movie for me. But he says something, that this movie is placed in an alternate parallel universe to ours. And it's very true, because there is no such thing as that. They're also an allegory for something else, something as dumb and stupid as perhaps the current regime, because that's what it is.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And I guess that's the foundation for the allegory, for those symbolisms, right? Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
I believe but that
it's the stupidity of their cause, that it's fucking bananas. Because technically they are the equivalent of the fucking clan. It is about race, purity, whatever else. But the fact that they also, Ricky, what do they believe in? Because please, they believe in fucking Santa Claus, dude. They're using Saint Nick. Yeah. It's
Saint Nicholas, you know, may be bountiful this season. Oh, this is our Christmas episode.
That's what I'm fucking saying. It's a Christmas movie. But even the knock on the door, the secret knock that they have, was like a fucking...
Jingle bells.
Yeah, jingle bells.
It's just... Dun, 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 dun,
dun, dun, dun. Yeah. But the... Like, again, this script has been written over 20 years. And we also know that PTA loves his, like, little secret hierarchical societies. Hence, he did The Master, which isn't about Scientology. Anyway,
Is it in the movie? I can't remember if Philip Seymour Hoffman is if it's named L. Ron Hubbard. No, it's never mentioned.
They purposely call him the Master, and they purposely don't introduce any other aspects of it, because let's be honest, PTA still wants to work.
Dude, they're not light-footed around it.
No, it is. But but again, it's not going clear, that documentary. It is the Master. It is a fictional piece of work. But what is interesting about this society is that some people might say it was QAnon, some people might say it's the current regime, but there's always been some sort of hierarchical, predominantly Caucasian group in America who have been trying to control things. I feel like I've heard that this film has also been taken by the right wingers, the people who lean very far to the right, as an allegory of why you shouldn't lean so far to the left as well, you know, because you're going to lead to terrorist activities that are, you know, it's just a very interesting film.
It's a dangerous film, like we said earlier.
But that's the thing. It's a great film, but it still has a lot of ambiguity about it, and yet for us, we're like, no, it doesn't. It is definitely left leaning. But there are people out there who are watching it, being like, look how stupid the left are. Most of this film wouldn't happen if the left weren't as stupid and as reactive as they are. And this is what it's going to lead to. And it's such a good film for that.
Absolutely, you know, blinking you miss it, and that's why that scene is kind of short for a reason. Is the Eddie Van Halen character, the cops, or the, you know, part of task force or whatever, they have someone who infiltrates the other side with fucking Molotovs, and he's the one that turns this into a riot. It works for them so that they can respond. That happens. That's a strategy. Mm-hmm. And that's something that they don't want the general public to fucking see. So this is a dangerous movie. He's pissed off a lot of people with this one. And
Van Halen.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I was almost disappointed that they didn't put some fucking Van Halen music there.
Yeah.
Send Eddie, Eddie Van Halen in.
Yeah.
We are going to put some Van Halen in this. There's no way we're not.
But yeah, I mean, like, there's so much in this film that doesn't actually lean either way in a weird way. Like, it never says that what the group are doing right at the start are the right way to go about things. It never says, I mean, it heavily says that Lockjaw is an unhinged, slightly schizophrenic individual. However, all he just likes the black ladies, as he says. I'm really locked.
You could argue this. There are some characters with PTASD in this movie.
That entire section of him spying on them, spying on her. Let's just get that straight. He's spying on her assets.
I see what you did there.
Yeah. Far out. It's a sexy movie as well, man.
But it's just the simple fact that when he goes in and corners her and says, "I don't care if you blow the place up, I want you to meet me in this place. Otherwise, it's all going to go to shit." That's it.
We were talking about this this movie being possibly the most playful PDA got to be in a while. And he's also paying homage to some giants in the industry, some big directors. Like, the entire getaway sequence from the bank reminded me of Michael Mann. Just the way the car's out, the way that's shot. Yeah. It's fantastic. It's fantastic because you're waiting for things to go wrong. You're waiting. You're there. You're like, you want to know. You want to fucking know what comes next. Just like that sequence at the end.
So according to Paul Thomas Anderson, the final chase scene is seen as a homage to classics like Bullet, French Connection,
Seven Ups,
Vanishing Point, The Sugarland Express, and Ronin.
Well, yeah,
and Ronin really, really well in that. Mm. I mean, because that's one of the best other chase sequences.
It's fucking fantastic. It's fantastic. Yeah.
You talked about Michael Mann. I mean, I think that's evident from the start of this film. You know, what I was talking about earlier about when you see the title One Battle After Another, that's a Michael Mann sequence, the way they're like shifting into the courthouses and it's cutting between each group and they're just being very clean. And it's just, this film is great. All right. I don't know what else to say.
Useless info for the fucking number nerds. The titling sequence of this film comes on at the 12 minute and 50 second mark. The title of this movie is uttered at the 13 minute and 21 second mark of this movie. That's when we hear One Battle After Another. Look, we can keep talking about this, but there's no way to this. You just need to watch it. Are we wholeheartedly, all of us, recommending it?
Yep. Yes.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah, there's a definite 100% yes on this.
We wouldn't have said multiple times throughout this podcast, stop what you're doing right now and just go watch the film. Come on. If we didn't recommend it.
I just wanted to highlight that this is Paul Thomas Anderson's fifth and final feature film with his assistant director, Adam Sommer.
Ooh.
And he died of cancer in November 27th, 2024. Just got to say that because there will be blood. The Master, Inherent Vice, and Licorice Pizza. He was the assistant director.
Mm. Which, by the way, very underrated, but Licorice Pizza, for people that just walk into it thinking it's one of the finest hangout movies I've seen. As in, you watch it and because it doesn't go from A to Z. Like, it's a very... Don't seek for the closure of a finale in that movie, because that's exactly what it is. It's a hangout movie. It's like, if you picture yourself as hanging out with these people, it's fucking fantastic. I liked it a lot, you know, but that's a different animal compared to this movie altogether. Perhaps you got some notes on guns, Steve, featured in this movie?
The only gun I really wanted to mention was the Remington 700 hunting rifle, which was handed to him by Benicio del Toro.
Nice.
That is a BDL version, and it's obviously he tries to take that attempt on Lockjaw's life with it, and it's perfect. It's a nice hunting rifle.
Did Benicio, man, everything that comes out of his mouth, even the beat when he gets stopped by the cops and he's doing the little dance, and they go, how much did you drink? And he goes, a few small beers.
Yeah, it's great. What did you throw out? It's like rubbish.
Yeah, exactly. Rubbish.
But like, even you mentioning that rifle had more of a character arc than Leonardo DiCaprio did in this catalyst,
for sure. I mean, it's just the simple fact that he was trying to reach out while we're in that room as well, and he was trying to get under the bed to pull out the gun, and it's just like all those little bits. Yeah, there is a Negev Commando, which is the one which. His daughter is using while firing with the nuns, which was quite a nice and a very similar style standing and standpoint to her mum.
But what's the thing that is on top of the barrel? That it's like you always in video games, you can, I always put that on.
It's a
sight.
Night sight. Yeah.
It's like a laser sight, yeah. Or no? It's like a...
Yeah, so it's a hologram sight on that one.
Okay. See, yeah. I can still light it up. It's a hologram. He looked like Lockjaw trying to fucking.
No.
Trying to get hard. Like fucking.
Far from that.
Dude, we were talking about the suspense being built into sequences so masterfully, and we have another, which again, to make an object the catalyst or something, like a car or a driving sequence. So in this case, it was a paternity test machine. Yeah. And the entire exchange happens as you're waiting for the lines to line up. You don't know how this machine works. You don't know if it's real. You don't know if it's, but it doesn't matter. Because all of a sudden you are waiting for this device that may or may not be real to give you something as the viewer. And it fucking did that to me. I'm waiting. They are waiting. He's waiting. She's waiting. And I, as the viewer, I am waiting for these lines to line up. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm pretty sure that that's not a real machine, right? I don't know. But it looks real. So there's verity. We are waiting for confirmation for this thing that might as well be a fucking transporter from Star Trek. It's, you know what I mean? But it matters. You want to see the lines. You want to see the lines line up. And there are shots, callbacks to it as it's happening. You're waiting for the results. You want to know. But anyway, I think it's ratings times.
A 9.
Nice.
There you go. But I see. Although I had problems with the length of this movie, I still really, really deeply enjoyed this movie. And I'm going to say it's 9 rockets being fired by the Rocket Man.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
So for me, this is a 9. I have to mirror Steve. We actually, for our listeners, we write scores down. We started doing that a long time ago, like halfway through our run, because we started realizing that maybe we didn't want to fall into the trap of mirroring each other. So we write it down, and then if they match, they match. I wrote down a 9 as well. This is a 9. It's a 9 disrespected to the Tamis. It's a movie that I highly recommend. It is, and this is a big call, but we are at the end of 2025. And in my opinion, this is the best movie of 2025. You owe it to yourself to see it from a civic standpoint as well, as a human being, as a citizen, or wherever the fuck you live. If you do live in the US, if you do live in Europe, anywhere in Europe, it's undeniable that there are dark forces at play. And this is a very dangerous movie because of that. But it is also, there's levity in it. It's a romantic movie, if you want to see it. It's fine for date night. The only thing that works against it is the running time, but not for me. Absolutely not for me. In fact, I promised I would post a shot of me not wanting to fragment this watch. So I did it. I just turned the TV in my mom's guest room here in Rome while I'm visiting so that I wouldn't stop watching it, because I couldn't stop watching it. So I highly recommend it. There's everything in it. It's a dangerous movie. It's an important movie. And the performance is among the finest you'll see in a while. So it's memorable. And that's what you want from anything you spend your valuable time on.
Thank you for your 9. Thank you for your other 9. I think everybody knows how much of a PTA head I am, and mine was and it's not going to come in view, but it's a 9.2. It didn't come in view at all, but it's a 9. 8.2. This is by far, it feels like the most, as Umbar said, fun that PTA has had in a film. It also feels like a genuine call to arms for everybody who is involved in this film. There are so many shots in this. There are so many little quirky bits. And to be honest, I couldn't even see Sean Penn in that role. All I saw was Lockjaw. I didn't see Sean Penn as an actor in this film. So 9.2, what? 9.2 and another classic line. 9.2 little Latino Harriet Tubman situations.
Mate, there's no way that I'm not changing all of my passwords to Mexican hairless. And on that note, this was Umba.
This was Steve.
And this is Ricky.
Oh yeah.